Welcome back, my friends. This time, in this episode, I am happy to be joined for a wonderful schmooze by a friend who, it turns out, we share a lot in common, both personally and professionally. I'll tell you his name, and I'm sure that his fans all over the world will recognize it, maybe not all of you, and then I'll tell you whom I'm talking about. He was born in the Bronx, and that's one of the things we have in common. I was born in the Bronx. He was born as Harold Lifschitz, born in the Bronx, and he started his career as a musician and singer in the 1950s in the big band era. He then went on to star on Broadway in many shows. One of them we have in common as well, we'll talk about, and eventually on television. And this will be a giveaway among so many different things. He got his big break in 1974 and is known all over the world, not as Harold Lifschitz, but as Hal Linden. And the big break was Barney Miller. And so I am thrilled to be joined by my friend, Hal Linden. Hal, thank you for joining me. It is really a joy to have you. And first of all, you said that we're both sitting in our chapels.
Chapels.
The Hal Linden Chapel and the Mike Burson Chapel. It's all on the wall. Everything we've done is hanging right now. But
your introduction was proper. Let me fix two things. It was Lifschitz with a P.
Oh.
And secondly, I started, I joined the Musicians Union in 1946, not the 50s. I was playing with big bands in the 40s at the age of 15.
And what I also forgot to mention that we have in common, we both went to the High School of Music and Art.
Oh, there you go.
Although at different times, but it doesn't matter. It wasn't that far between. First of all, let me say that we are taping this, or we're filming this. We're not even filming. It's all digital now. February, and it's the first anniversary, unfortunately, of the world's changing due to the COVID mishigas. So let me ask you, it's been a year now. We've all changed. Have you been coping?
Coping? Like everybody else, you know, at home, a lot at home. I do a lot of reading now, couch potatoing. I'm guilty of all of it. It's been tough. It's been tough. But every Sunday, I Zoom with my four kids. I see as many grandchildren on there as possible.
Yeah.
I spend the weekends with my lady friend, trying to make do.
Yeah.
We do.
I guess coping is the wrong word. Surviving, I guess, is
surviving.
And adjusting to the new reality. That's something that's going to be with us.
I'm afraid so. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to slide back to normal. I don't think it will.
No.
We're going to be doing a lot of this, I think, yeah, in the future, which we never did in the past.
And it's strange that sometimes, negative things can also have a positive aspect, because I've been talking, as I'm sure you have as well, to people all over the world that I haven't spoken to or seen for years.
Yeah,
and it's amazing. You just turn on the computer, and I see family in Israel, in Paris, and in South America. That's something that we've been blessed with, I guess. It's a new reality.
Yeah, I don't have family in Israel or Paris or South America, unfortunately.
But Hal, you know, we
and
are.
And by the way, most of my friends, I'm afraid, are dead.
Well, we are. I still think we are the lucky ones, you know.
We certainly are. I mean, listen, I've been lucky my whole life. I said I was a musician at age 15. Understand that that was 1946. Everybody was in the army and they had to hire a 15-year-old saxophone player, singer. There was nobody else. So I, through the luck of time and, you know, the calendar, I started my career and I had a very good professional musical career from that, because of that, right from scratch. So luck has always been on the side. And I can give you two or three more examples of luck in my life, certainly.
But I wanna start just reminiscing a little bit. The first time, and you reminded me of this, I had forgotten. The first time we really met, and by the way, when you mention your saxophone player, but I love your clarinet playing, because not long ago we were down in Florida and we were both performing for the lovely people in the condominiums, right, which is unfortunately right now it's all closed. But we came to see one of your performances, and what we loved, my Siona and I loved the most, was your clarinet playing. I mean, it is.
I started on the clarinet. I started as a classically trained clarinet player, and very good, by the way. If I had any sense of discipline, I probably would have spent my life in the first chair of a major symphony somewhere. That should have been. As I reached my teenage years and the hormones started to flow, I also took up the saxophone so that I could play with bands, because I discovered that more girls went to dances than went to concerts. So purely hormone driven, I became a jazz musician. And that, and if I had any discipline that way, I probably would have ended up with the major bands as a major saxophone player. But such was my lack of discipline that I slid off into the theater, give that a shot and see what happens. And look what happened.
I would love to have you do the solo in Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, that solo that starts with a clarinet. So, hey, it's never too late, you know?
Never too late.
Never too late.
Some years ago, well, in my concerts, whenever you saw the show that I did.
I did.
Whenever I did that show with symphonies, I would do the third movement, third movement of the Mozart.
Wow.
With a symphony. Imagine having the ability to do that. I've done it with major symphonies all across America. What a talk about luck. How many people get to play the Mozart clarinet concerto with a major symphony?
By the way, have you had your vaccines?
One. Two is coming up in, I think, about a week or 10 days.
A week
from today.
A week more. We got ours as well. So I'm...
Are you a Pfizer or a Moderna?
I'm a Pfizer.
I'm a Moderna.
You're a Moderna, I'm a Pfizer.
There you go.
Okay. 1969, I was in New York, and we had just come with a musical from Israel, a Yiddish musical called The Megillah on Broadway, the first time an Israeli show. And as a matter of fact, I'm preparing that now for this coming Sunday, February 21st, we're going to broadcast online a version of The Megillah for Purim. So that's gonna be, and at that time, a film that I had done in Israel, a very famous film called The Two Kuni Lemels, and someone had bought the rights to dub that film into English for an English version called The Flying Matchmaker. And so we dubbed it in a studio in New York. And what I didn't remember, and you reminded me, was that that was the first time that we worked together.
That's right.
At that time, we were doing a lot of that kind of work.
That supported me through the 60s. supported me through the 60s. I was very good at it, so I worked at it all the time. I would get into a Broadway show in September, go into rehearsal, open out of town in October, come in November. It was a flop, and we'd be closed by the end of the year. And then the rest of the year, I had to do something. I spent a lot of time doing, in those days, if you remember, there were three channels. And if any place that had a fourth channel, an independent channel, New York had two or three other channels, and they had no content. So they would take European B pictures. Most of the A pictures, European A pictures, got to the theaters, but European B pictures, unknown actors, to fill the slots on Channel 11 or Channel 9 or whatever it was everywhere in America. And so we spent a lot of time. I was the voice of I Am Curious Yellow, War and Peace. I did the Russian War and Peace that won the Oscar. We did the English version. All those pictures of the 50s and 60s that wanted to do into English. There was a company in New York that did it, and that, as I say, supported my kids through the 60s until I finally got a major role on Broadway. So that I look back very fondly on those days up at Teacher.
And look how life is so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we come full circle, because after 10 years is that since 1969, just recently this year, I was lucky enough to direct the English dub of a Spanish movie that Netflix purchased. And they hired me to dub the English version, and I had to cast it with local actors. And the first role that I thought of, and this was the key role in this movie, it's called Below Zero. And it went to number one on Netflix just a couple of weeks ago around the world. The key role in this movie was a former policeman. I don't want to give away the story, but it was the key role, and a very dramatic role. And immediately I thought of Hal. And I spoke to the people at Netflix, and they said, "Oh, sure, yeah, you're going to get Hal Linden." I said, "Look, I'm not joking. I know Hal. We go back a long while. Do you mind if I try?" They said, "Yeah, sure, go ahead." Well, I called Hal. And don't forget, this is during COVID, and it wasn't that easy to get around. They had to sanitize the studios. We were a little, SAG was very, very cautious about bringing actors in. And immediately he said yes. And they couldn't believe it, but Hal came in. And after all these years, but the difference today is like night and day.
Oh, yeah, well.
The way it used to be before and the way it is now, but Hal did such an amazing, amazing performance that you really think you're listening to the original Spanish actor. So
turned out lovely. I saw it. It turned out lovely.
Yeah, I mean, life is interesting,
It was only 42 years ago. 43? How many years ago?
I think it's more. It's more.
69.
69.
That's 50.
52.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen. Okay, so let's move on.
And we were adults at the time.
Well, I don't know about you. You were an adult. I was a kid at that time still. Not exactly, but I won't give it away. Now I want to move on to another thing that we share. In 1970, I believe it was, yes, I was in New York after the Megilla, and I was lucky to be cast by a wonderful director, Alan Schneider, He was directing a dramatization of the Rosenberg trial. He needed someone to portray Roy Cohn, of all people. I was exactly the right age, and Alan knew me from Israel. He had directed there, and he gave me the part. And so I played Roy Cohn, and I was hissed and booed every night on stage. But at the same time...
Typecasting, Mike, typecasting.
Oh, yeah. Although I was born in the Bronx, and he was from Brooklyn. I had to put on a Brooklyn accent.
He was from hell.
Well, interestingly enough, I called him and I tried to meet with him because I was going to portray him. And
he was still alive, of course.
And he agreed to meet with me. But the producers found out about that. There were Goober and Gross, if you remember the producers.
Oh, I remember Lee
Goober. And at the time he was married to Barbara Walters, actually.
Yes.
They found out about this. They called me into the office and they said, young man, we hear you're going to meet with Roy Cohn. I said, well, yeah, I want you to do some research. I'm an actor. They said, well, we'll give you two choices. You can meet with Roy Cohn and you're fired. Or you can forget about this meeting and you'll keep your job. I said, why? I couldn't understand it. They said, that fear of what he was capable of doing. They said he might take out an injunction and use that as an excuse to stop the show. But I could sense the fear of the 1950s, that time of Roy, the influence he and McCarthy had on people at that time. And they were still in fear of what he might do. And obviously I didn't meet with him because I wanted to keep my job. Well, that's interesting. But at that time, I got a call from my agent, at the time I was with William Morris, to audition for a new musical that was written by the same people who wrote Fiddler on the Roof, Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick. And I went to audition, and it was for a musical called The Rothschilds. Auditioned for one of the sons, for Nathan, and I didn't get the part because the original director was you probably remember his name from England. Yeah. He had directed Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Right, and Guildenstern.
And they figured he's British, so he can direct the British musical. Anyway, I didn't get the part. And lo and behold, my friend Hal won the Tony Award for that show, playing Meyer Rothschild in The Rothschilds. And from what I understand, you have to tell the story that Danny Arnold, who eventually produced Barney Miller, that's when he first saw you, right? Is that true?
We talked about lucky breaks and lucky circumstances in our life.
Right.
He was in New York shooting a movie. I think it was a Jack Lemmon movie. I don't remember the name of it. He had written it and was associate producer on the set. They had to change lines or something, so he was there for the shoot. And I think his two kids, he had two little boys, his wife sent them to be with him for Christmas week or whatever it was, and he was busy. So he got the stage manager to put the kids in the car, got him a limo, and they either took him to the museum or a Knick game in the afternoon or around the sail around Manhattan, whatever. Keep the kids busy till the evening when I could spend time with the kids. And the kids, after about 3 or 4 days of this, they revolted and said, no, we want to stay with you. At which point he tried to explain to the kids that he couldn't spend any time with them, when the director overheard this and said, listen, we got a company move, which is very, in New York City, that's a big thing. It would take all afternoon to move from one location to another. He said, we're never going to get to anything. Go with your kids, whatever. Spend the day with your kids. So he got in the car with the kids and came to see the Rothschilds at a matinee. I never knew he was there. He never sent me a note. He didn't come backstage. I didn't know the man existed. 2 years later, he was casting Barney Miller. And, you know, the network gives you a list. They say, here are some TV names for each of the parts, you know. And he just brushed it aside. He said, no, I saw this actor on Broadway. I'm going to use him. That was it. No agent submitted me. No audition. No nothing. He just had seen me and recognized the quality of the character that I could play, that I played on Broadway, that he wanted in the character. Because I eventually asked him, what did you see on that stage where I played what? An 18th century Jewish
merchant
with, you know, what did you see in him that you wanted in Barney? Danny said to me, I wanted to imbue Barney with a Talmudic sense of justice. And I saw you, and that's what I saw in you, that you could recognize sitting at a desk that across from some perp there, but for the grace of who knows what, go all of us, to have that sense of, as he phrased it, Talmudic justice. And that was the, as I say, a man walked in, went to the theater not of his own accord that afternoon, and look at how it changed my life.
Yeah. And I think also Danny, I mean, after a while, I got to know him very well as well, but I think he also saw something of him in you.
It was said of Danny that every character was Danny. Every character was some part of Danny, or what Danny wished or wanted to be. Even the strange characters had a little bit of Danny. It's entirely possible, because Danny was such a, you know, every character had that strain of humanity in him, even the weird ones. Yeah.
And he was such an innovator. I mean, people don't realize the innovations that he did when he was shooting Barney Miller.
The technological innovations.
Innovations using three cameras.
That predate, now it's, yeah, it's common. And now they do it digitally. You don't even have to, he had to do it physically, you know.
Well, that's also an interesting, so here are two other common things that we have, because despite the fact that in 1970, I didn't get the part. Ironically, I remember that after a couple of weeks, they fired that director, right? And he didn't even.
It was more than a couple of weeks. It was in Detroit. We were already running when he was replaced.
And who replaced him?
Michael Kidd.
Oh, Michael Kidd. Yeah.
Michael Kidd was the choreographer, and they made him the director.
So after 20 years later, I'm in New York, and I just came back from Holland. I'd done a tour in Holland of Barnum that I had done on Broadway, and I was doing a show at the American Jewish Theater, and they were about to produce a revival of the Rothschilds.
That's right.
And to my luck, again, there we go, 20 years after I didn't get to play the son,
I got to play the father.
And yeah, we did a revival of the Rothschilds in New York in a small little theater under a supermarket. We got such great reviews that we moved to Circle in the Square in the Village, and it ran for over a year. And so I was lucky enough to do the same role you did 20 years earlier. And then here we go with the next, Bashert, as we say. Bashert is things are meant to be.
Fate.
1972 and 73, I was in Los Angeles opening an Israeli nightclub. And I get a call again from my agent to go and see a producer who is about to cast a new series. And it was Danny Arnold. And I came to Danny, and something happened. There was a chemistry there. And he said, you know what? I'm going to do, I have to submit two lists of candidates to ABC. And I'd like you to audition for one of the roles. And it was the role of a young district attorney that was courting Barney's daughter in the original pilot. Right. And Danny said, you know, I'm going to do the audition with you. I will do it. I will shoot it with you. And we did. He submitted it. And make a long story short, it turns out there was a Jewish vice president at ABC who thought I looked too Jewish.
Too Jewish.
Too Jewish. The character was a Jewish kid.
Yeah.
But Danny was furious, but he, you know, he had no choice. He didn't want to obviously lose the series. And I didn't get that part. But
I remember the payoff of that part too.
Didn't they kill him off? Didn't they kill him off?
No. He was assistant DA, and he was going to go into practice for his own, and he printed his first card, and he had just given me the card. I had it in my pocket when I went into the station, and one of the perps had grabbed one of the cops' gun and was holding everybody at bay when I walked in the door. That was the subject of the first show. And I got to talk to him, try to talk him down to put the gun down. And I said, you know, as a matter of fact, I got a lawyer for you. And I showed him the card. I don't remember what the character's name was, but it was, I don't know, Feinstein, something like that. And the kid said, doesn't sound Puerto Rican. And I said, no, he's Jewish. Almost the same thing. That was the punchline. Almost the same thing. That was Danny. So
yeah,
I remember the punchline for that character.
Yeah, well, you know, what's funny is that they said, you know, what does it mean to look too Jewish?
I know.
They said, you know, you have to look like I forget the name of the actor who was in The Godfather. He played Sonny.
Jimmy Kahn.
Jimmy Kahn, yeah. They said you can look Jewish like Jimmy Kahn. That's the kind that's supposed to be okay.
We come from a different era, thank God.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank God that era is over.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you something. We talked about my doing looping to keep me alive in the 60s. Another thing that I did and was very good at, and I used to do at least one or two a year, as I say, just to keep groceries. I had four kids living in Manhattan, was industrial shows. And I was, you know, singing, dancing. I could sell the product. I was terrific at it. I was the big star of industrials, but not the major company of industrials. There was a major company of industrials called Jam Handy out of Detroit, Michigan. They did all the car shows. Never worked for them. I could never get arrested for them. Finally, it ended up, don't remember, one director wanted me and they wouldn't hire me. It was because I was too ethnic looking.
Yeah.
And now you're talking about those days where everybody had to look like Rock Hudson, you know, or Tab Hunter. You had to look American. Hopefully those days are over, but we went through it. We went through it specifically.
Which always reminds me what the African American community and our African American actors are finally getting their due after all the years that they went through. What we have to remind them, we went through it as well.
Oh, well, yeah. Everybody went through it, but they had it really bad.
They had it bad.
But I remember specifically in the 60s was, that choruses were always lily white. Nobody ever thought about putting a black guy in a chorus, even though he could probably sing better than, half the kids who were in it. And it was a directorial problem sometimes. I remember being up in, Summer Stock, and there was, I did an operetta in the chorus. And there was one line from a character in the chorus where he was he had a turban. He must have been there was something racial about the line, and I had to play the part. They didn't have any black actors there in the chorus or anybody. I remember the director trying to, how are we going to make you look? I didn't even know what it was. What the character was, but there was no concept that anybody could play any part. Let me put it that way. It's taken a long time to get to what we were fighting for in those days, quote, colorblind casting.
Colorblind, yeah, ethnic blind casting.
And ethnic diversity, so the stage looks like the audience,
Well,
it took a long time, but we were on the short end of it for a long time.
Well, Hal, I got to tell you, I am so grateful that you agreed to do this with me, because, I started this channel because we've all been sitting at home and trying to stay busy, and I was very lucky that I said, why don't I do just something to meet with my friends, since I can't meet with them physically. And I had this idea, and the first one I called was my dear, dear old friend, Norman Lear, Norman is now, I think he's like 98.
Something like that.
But he is amazing, and he was the first one to agree. I said, if I can get Norman to do it, then I think I can put this thing together. And since then, I've had very, very good friends come on, and you have really made it so special. So I thank you, and I always close the schmoozes with a question. And okay. I'm gonna ask this to you. If I were to ask you of one individual that inspired your life, who would it be?
Well, there wasn't one. There were so many. There were so many. In the beginning, it was my older cousins who were professional musicians who inspired me to keep, I'm talking first chair viola, NBC Symphony, and concertmaster of the Golden Band. These were my cousins. I was the youngest one. So in the beginning, it was their professionalism, that inspired me to keep going and become a professional. In the theater, it's been, I don't think I can nail it down to one person. It was watching great performances, knowing that, hoping that I could somehow dig into performances, watching people like Brando and Dustin Hoffman and Screen in his early, watching them dig and hoping that I could spend my life digging, Danny was an idol of mine. I thought I never met anyone who had such wit. He was the only comedic genius that I knew at the time. I've since met quite a few more, but so there were so many people who inspired me. But I kind of went with the flow. I got to tell you, I had very few guide rails for my career. I just went with the flow, trying to feed a family of four on, you know, on the west side of Manhattan. I never expected that anybody would know my name. All I wanted to be was, you know, capable of doing all the roles. I'll tell you a quick story. There were two movie theaters on Broadway and 96th and 7th, the Riverside and the something, Symphony, not the Symphony, the Riverside and the, I can't remember the other one. Two movie theaters.
Symphony Space.
Huh?
I think it was Symphony Space.
No. That was down. That was on 93rd or 4th.
Oh, okay.
North of 96th. There were two movie theaters. The same manager managed both movie theaters. They're gone now. They built a new building there. But he had a sense of humor, and he would bill local residents who were in the movies. So you would come by and it would say, Eli Wallach in A Fistful of Dollars with Clint Eastwood, you know. Or it would say Walter Matthau in Charade, also Cary Grant, you know. And it was my, what, desire, my, one day they'll put my name up there in some movie that I've made. Unfortunately, they tore the theaters down before I ever got there. but I'm telling you, that was the thing. If anybody had known me as well as they knew Eli Wallach, you know what I mean? A functioning, working, good actor. That's all I ever aspired to. But luck sticks its head in the door. And some people, I mean, I knew so many great actors who never had luck, who never quite got that moment that did it for them. I know actors who had to give up acting. Good actors, really good actors.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is luck. And by the way, the next show, by the way, I did after the Rothschilds was with Alan Schneider. And also one other observation before we close. My pictures are more crooked than yours. And I'm going to have to climb up there and straighten out all those. I don't know. Maybe I got to do something with them.
Well, when this COVID mishigas is over, I'll come over and I'll take a ladder and I'll help you get up there.
Okay.
Hal, okay. It's been a joy. And as soon as I get another Netflix Spanish movie, movie or any other movie, you're at the top of my list.
It's you got it.
Such a pleasure. And I wish you, you know, luck in our language is mazel. And it's also being at the right place at the right time. You know, timing is everything. So I wish you, first of all, the best of health. May you go on from strength to strength. And bis hindert und zwanzig, as we say in Yiddish, till 120. And we'll meet on happy occasions. So
good to see you again.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks so much. And thank you, my friends out there, for joining us. And see you next time on Mike Burstyn and Friends.
Okay.
Shalom.